Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
James Cook and his wife Samantha Jones started their beekeeping work 8 years ago. "You have to be a little crazy," Cook said. He and Jones knew the problems their bees face. These include harmful organisms called parasites and insect-killing farm chemicals. Even so, they were hopeful. The year 2020 was to be their year to go into business on their own after working several years for another beekeeper. Cook, Jones, and their bees spent the past winter in California's huge almond farms. In the spring, the farms, or orchards, are full of white flowers that turn into nuts. The crop is possible because of the many beekeepers who travel with their hives to pollinate the nation's crops. Then, the coronavirus health crisis hit. Cook and Jones became concerned. "Do we stay? Do we go?" they asked each other. By that time, they had taken their hives from California's San Joaquin Valley to another temporary home. Their plan was to let the bees recover from the agricultural work and their contact with farm chemicals. There, they raised Nux. These are groups of bees with new queens that can be used to start a new hive. The couple sells them to other beekeepers to replace bees that are lost over a season. Selling Nux and almond pollination represent about 2/3 of their business. The other 1/3 is honey making. They make honey during the summer at their permanent base, a farm in Wisconsin. Agricultural workers are considered essential. Beekeeping generally does not require Jones and Cook to be near other people. So, they decided to wait out the coronavirus restrictions in California. Then, they returned with their bees back to Iola, Wisconsin. There, they set out to create their brand, Bird and the Bees Honey. The bird is their parrot, which often rides in their truck. The parrot also happens to like honey. This summer, Cook and Jones and their small crew worked day and night to build a honey factory out of old truck trailers. They were extremely tired and in debt because they took loans to get the business up and running. But they were also excited. The 38-year-old Jones noted how much of the honey available in stores is mixed and cooked. "And I thought that people deserved good honey," she said. Unlike other agricultural crops, honey also can be stored for a long time. That is a good thing for Cook and Jones, because coronavirus restrictions have left them with fewer places to sell their products. Farmers' markets have been limited. So have restaurants and breweries. Such businesses also buy and use honey. Cook, who is 35, said the experience of starting a business in these difficult times will make them more resilient. I think beekeeping sort of taught me you kind of need to look for the optimism and the beauty that you can find, he says. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. October 31st is Halloween, a very popular holiday in the United States. Many people look forward to Halloween all year long. Today, the holiday brings in billions of dollars to businesses, and people of all ages take part in celebrations.
This year, however, the coronavirus pandemic means Halloween will look a little different. Many traditional activities and events have been canceled or changed. These activities include trick-or-treating, corn mazes, outdoor festivals, and indoor haunted houses.
People celebrating Halloween must consider new restrictions and concerns for health and safety. The Associated Press talked to families, event organizers, and others about the effects of COVID-19 on their Halloween plans.
Large community events and outdoor festivals across the U.S. have been canceled or changed. Near the city of San Francisco, California, a well-known Halloween event was supposed to celebrate its 50th anniversary this year. Now it has been canceled. The Half Moon Bay Art and Pumpkin Festival is a two-day event. In normal times, about 300,000 people come to see the parade and contests, including California's heaviest pumpkin.
Many neighborhoods across the U.S. hold big Halloween parties. Streets shut down to vehicles, and people living on the street throw parties. Some streets become well known for their Halloween celebrations. An area called Webster Groves, near St. Louis, Missouri, is one example. People who live there decorate their houses, give out candy, and have parties. As many as 1,000 people visit for Halloween, but not this year. One homeowner there said her family plans to decorate the outside of their house as usual. She wants her neighbors to feel the Halloween spirit, but they will not give out candy. This year, many farms with corn mazes must also make changes because of COVID-19. For example, walkways through the fields of corn are wider than usual. The farms are limiting the number of visitors, and people must wear face masks in places where they cannot stay physically distanced.
Indoor attractions, such as haunted houses, are having difficulties operating this holiday. Brett Hayes is president of the Haunted Attraction Association. The association has about 800 members in the United States. He told the AP that about half of the country's haunted houses will not be able to run this year because of the pandemic. A few haunted houses have created ways for people to experience the fun from their vehicles. Others plan to let in a limited number of people at a time. Haunted houses and other attractions usually make about $1.14 billion in yearly ticket sales, mostly during Halloween season. But this year, many expect to see a 50% decrease in usual earnings. "Nobody's going to have a great year," Hayes said.
Trick-or-treating is the main Halloween activity for children and families. Children dress up in costume and then go door-to-door asking for candy, while singing, "Trick-or-treat, trick-or-treat, give me something good to eat." Even people without children enjoy dressing up in costumes and giving out candy to children who come to their door.
But trick-or-treating presents health concerns in the age of the coronavirus. Children usually need to get close to the person giving out the candy. It is difficult to stay a safe distance away. Each area of the United States is dealing with trick-or-treating differently. Many cities and states have canceled trick-or-treating. And many parents are still deciding whether to let their children go trick-or-treating.
In Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood, Jamie Bender is mom to two kids, ages 3 and 5. She said she is still deciding whether her family will go trick-or-treating. "If our neighbors are wearing masks when they open the door," she said, "we would let the kids trick-or-treat a few houses." Bender added she would then clean the candy covers before letting her children eat them.
Still, Americans are buying a lot of Halloween candy. The AP reports that U.S. sales of Halloween candy were up 13% over last year in the period ending September 6th. Experts say this is likely because Americans may want to celebrate after months of worry and concern. People are thinking of safer ways to give candy to trick-or-treaters. Some say they will use long sticks or other devices to safely deliver candy from a distance. Others say they will just throw candy at children and hope it lands close by.
15-year-old Alina Morse lives in Detroit, Michigan. She developed a candy company. She also created a Halloween tree. The tree lets children pick a piece of candy, or two, or three, but still stay physically distanced. Alina told the AP that selecting a treat from the tree makes the safe, self-serve experience much more fun.
That excitement is good news for candy companies. Halloween is the biggest holiday of the year for candy makers. Miranda Leon of Albany, Georgia, still plans to buy Halloween candy. And she plans to take her children trick-or-treating and give out candy.
"So much has been taken from our kids this year. Classes cut, sports canceled, summer camps canceled," she said. "I refuse to take away the joy of trick-or-treating from my kids." And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus.
If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. One day in October of 1859, Americans were shocked by news of an attack led by John Brown. He was an anti-slavery extremist. Many people also considered him a madman. John Brown had declared that he was ready to die fighting slavery. He said that God wanted him to fight slavery by invading Virginia with a military force. And even if the rebellion failed, he predicted that it would lead to a civil war between the North and the South. Should there be a war, he said, the North would break the chains of black slaves. Brown decided to strike at Harper's Ferry, a small town about 100 kilometers from Washington. It was part of Virginia at that time, but is now located in the state of West Virginia. It had a factory that made guns for the army and a supply center of valuable military equipment. Brown wanted the guns and equipment for the slave army he hoped to organize. Harper's Ferry was built on a narrow finger of land where the Shenandoah River flows into the Potomac. There was a bridge across each river. Brown organized his attack from across the Potomac in Maryland. Harry Monroe and Jack Moyles continue the story of John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry.
With his force of less than 20 men, John Brown moved through the darkness down to the bridge that crossed the Potomac River. Two men left the group to cut the telegraph lines east and west of Harper's Ferry. At the bridge, Brown's men surprised a railroad guard. They told him he was their prisoner. The guard thought they were joking until he saw their guns. Once across the bridge, Brown and his men moved quickly. They captured a few people in the street and another guard at the front gate of the government armory. They seized the armory, then crossed the street and seized the supply center. Millions of dollars worth of military equipment was kept there.
After leaving a few men to guard the prisoners, Brown and the others went to the gun factory across town. They seized the few people who were there and captured the factory. Without firing a shot, Brown now controlled the three places he wanted in Harper's Ferry. His problem now was to hold what he had captured. Brown knew he had little time. The people of the town would soon learn what had happened. They would call for help, and several groups of militia in the area would come to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Brown planned to use the people he had captured as hostages. The militia would not attack if there was danger of harming the prisoners. He wanted as many prisoners as possible to protect himself. If his plan failed, he could offer them in exchange for his own freedom and that of his men.
Brown had decided to capture as his best hostage Colonel Lewis Washington. The colonel was a descendant of President George Washington. He lived on a big farm near Harper's Ferry. Brown sent some of his men to capture the old colonel and free his slaves. They returned from the Washington farm after midnight. They brought Colonel Washington and 10 slaves. They also captured another farmer and his son. The slaves were given spears and told to guard the prisoners. Then, at the far end of the Potomac River Bridge, the first shots were fired. Brown's son, Watson, and another man fired at a railroad guard who refused to halt. A bullet struck his head, but did not hurt him seriously. The guard raced back across the bridge to the railroad station. He cried out that a group of armed men had seized the bridge.
A few minutes later, a train from the west arrived at Harper's Ferry. The wounded guard warned the trainmen of the danger at the bridge. Two of the trainmen decided to investigate. They walked toward the bridge. Before they could reach it, bullets began whizzing past them. They ran back to the train and moved it farther from the bridge. Then a free Negro man who worked at the railroad station, Hayward Shepherd, walked down to the bridge. Brown's men ordered him to halt. Shepherd tried to run and was shot. He got back to the station, but died several hours later.
Brown finally agreed to let the train pass over the bridge and continue on to Baltimore. The train left at sunrise. By this time, word of Brown's attack had spread to Charlestown, more than 12 kilometers away. Officials called out the militia, ordering the men of Charlestown to get ready to go to the aid of Harper's Ferry. Soon after sunrise, men began arriving at Harper's Ferry from other towns in the area. They took positions above the armory and started shooting at it. The militia from Charlestown arrived at the Maryland end of the Potomac Bridge. They charged across, forcing Brown's men on the bridge to flee to the armory. Only one of Brown's men was hit. He was killed instantly.
Brown saw that he was surrounded. His only hope was to try to negotiate a ceasefire and offer to release his 30 hostages if the militia would let him and his men go free. Brown sent out one of his men and one of the prisoners with a white flag. The excited crowd refused to recognize the white flag. They seized Brown's man and carried him away. Brown moved his men and the most important of his hostages into a small brick building at the armory. Then he sent out two more of his men with a prisoner to try to negotiate a ceasefire. One of them was his son, Watson.
This time the crowd opened fire. Watson and the other raider were wounded. Their prisoner escaped to safety. Watson was able to crawl back to the armory. One of the youngest of Brown's men, William Lehman, tried to escape. He ran from the armory and jumped into the Potomac, planning to swim across the river. He did not get far. A group of militia saw him and began shooting. Lehman was forced to hide behind a rock in the middle of the river. Two men went out to the rock with guns and shot him. His body lay in the river for 2 days. Later, more people were killed. One was the mayor of Harper's Ferry, Fontaine Beckham.
After the mayor's death, a mob went to the hotel where one of Brown's men had been held since he was seized earlier in the day. They pulled him from the hotel and took him to the bridge over the river. Several members of the mob put guns to his head and fired. They pushed his body off the bridge and into the water. Across town, three of Brown's men were in trouble at the gun factory. The factory was built on an island in the Shenandoah River. The island was now surrounded by militia. 40 of the soldiers attacked the factory from three sides. They pushed the three raiders back to a small building next to the river. The three men fought as long as possible. Then they jumped through a window into the river. They tried to swim to safety. Men with guns were waiting for them. Bullets fell around the three like rain. One man was hit. He died instantly. Another was wounded. He was pulled to land and left to die. The third man escaped death. He was captured and held for trial.
All through the afternoon and evening, Brown's men at the armory continued to exchange shots with the militia. Several more on both sides were killed or wounded. One of those was another of Brown's sons, Oliver. He was shot and seriously wounded. Night fell. Then a militia officer, Captain Sin, walked up to the small building held by Brown. He shouted to the men inside that he wished to talk. Brown opened the door and let him in. For almost an hour, the two men talked. They talked about slavery and the right to rebel against the government.
Brown was furious that the crowd outside had refused to honor his white flag of truce earlier in the day. He told Sin that his men could have killed unarmed men and women, but did not do so. "That is not quite correct," Captain Sin said. "Mayor Beckham had no gun when he was shot." "Then I can only say I am most sad to hear it," said Brown. "Men who take up guns against the government," said Sin, "must expect to be shot down like dogs."
In Washington, President Buchanan and Secretary of War John Floyd did not learn of the rebellion at Harper's Ferry until after 10 o'clock that morning. The president wanted immediate action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.